G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's a Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs, as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you may miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, I would like to introduce you to Lara Bolger, who is doing a PhD in Cultural Studies under the supervision of Dr. Corinne Bertrand. Welcome to Grad Chat, Lara.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I've listened to quite a few episodes in the past, so it's an honor to be recording myself.
That's great. Some people get very scared about doing this, but I'm glad you're okay doing this. And I understand, actually, you've got your own podcast as well. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. So, well, this was a COVID project, but my friend Cheryl and I, we're both big movie people. I mean, you can probably tell that from my research, but she lives in the UK and we hadn't seen each other in a few years. So we were like, oh, it would be so fun to start a podcast. We've got a lot of time and basically we're just going to talk about movies. Sometimes it's movies that we've seen before and we love, and other times we try to get out of our comfort zone. Like right now we're doing a gangster film genre where we watch a different gangster film every month. And I think this is out of both of our comfort zones, particularly mine, but it's been interesting because otherwise I don't think I would have watched films like, I don't know, Goodfellas and Snatch. Right. These are not what I gravitate towards typically.
Well, it's funny because it's interesting, like with movies, I watch movies and I read books and I do it more for the enjoyment factor. I don't always think about what was the point behind the movie or behind the book? Was there a message there for us that was weaved in between the whole plot line or storyline? And it wasn't until we did Queen's Read at Queen's here that I got to read all these other books to see whether we put it out there for students to read. And when I first read it, it was all about, oh, that was a good fun book, as opposed to this is what they were trying to say within the book. You know, what's between the lines, what can we read? And so I think the fact that you're doing that with movies too, it's a great way of, as you said, seeing movies that you probably wouldn't, although I would never go and look at all the scary ones. I would stop.
Yeah, well, that's the same with my friend Cheryl. She's not a big fan of scary movies, so I don't think we will ever do a scary movie genre. It's too far out of her comfort zone, but it's fun and it's sort of light, you know. We don't do it in a very academic way,
which is so nice sometimes, because when you do it academic you have to think in a certain way, and it's nice just to, no, this is what I reckon. And it wasn't until other people make other comments and you think, oh, I hadn't thought of that, but you know what, didn't matter, I still enjoyed it. You know, those sorts of things. So what made you get interested in movies in the first place? Is it from a young kid, you go to the movies all the time, or?
Yeah, it's hard to pinpoint exactly when it was. My parents have always loved movies and we watched a lot of films when we were younger. And my initial career goals were to write film soundtracks.
Okay.
That is what I wanted to do because I loved and still love music and film. And I had fallen in love with so many film soundtracks in high school. So that's what I decided to try to pursue in undergrad. Didn't work out that way because I did not enjoy my theory or music composition courses. Those were my least favorites. And that's sort of the foundation upon which you have to build your career as a film composer. So I had studied music as my major and film as my minor. And yeah, just didn't end up going in that direction. Yeah. But I still knew that I wanted to work in film in one capacity or another. So I worked at a few different like film festivals and arts organizations in Toronto after my undergraduate degree. And a few years after that, I decided to go back to school again. And I went to Queen's for my master's, where I did a degree in arts leadership.
Yep.
So at that point, I was really interested in working in sort of management positions at arts organizations, like, you know, film festivals or theater organizations. And that was really interesting. That was a great way to learn more about not-for-profit arts organizations.
Right, yes.
But my focus was always film and film festivals specifically. So I worked at a couple more film and film festival organizations. And in particular, my work at an organization called the Documentary Organization of Canada made me realize that documentary was really what was most interesting to me about film, because I started thinking about the way that documentaries were able to impact people on an individual level, but also communities at large.
Right.
So a couple years after that, I decided to head back to school again and start my PhD at Queen's. And I chose the cultural studies program rather than the film program because it's a lot more interdisciplinary. And I find that so much of my research is not just film specific, right? I also think about like socio-political aspects of film. I think about the environment a lot. I write about the environment and all these different elements that are much more interdisciplinary. So I found that cultural studies has been a really good home for my research.
That's good. So I guess we should find out exactly what you're doing with documentary film. Because I must admit, I mean, documentary is very different to the blockbuster movies and things that we see. And I don't think we watch them enough. And so maybe after listening to you, people will watch them more. So, because it is fascinating. So with the fact that, you, I mean, it's a PhD, so there's lots that you can probably talk about. With looking at documentary film, is there a particular genre of documentary film that you're, analyzing or critiquing? Or, I mean, what exactly are you trying to do? First of all, which genre, and then what are you trying to do with when you're looking at this genre?
Mm-hmm. So, well, I will just say that I think documentary has this sort of reputation for being educational, and that's a big part of the reason that people shy away from documentaries. You know, if they want to watch a film, it's a Friday night, they might want something that's light, it's a romance, it's action. They might not want to sit down and feel like they are being taught.
Yeah, they don't want to think about it, do they? They just want to be entertained.
Yes, exactly. And a lot of documentaries today are entertaining. They do function as entertainment, but that can also just be one element of it. And I have to say, like, I do enjoy documentaries that have an educational bent to them, but I also still do want to be entertained. And I think that is more and more possible today, especially as documentaries have bigger budgets and are becoming somewhat more popular and more mainstream. But you had a specific question about my research focus, I think.
Yeah, what particular genre are you looking at for your PhD?
So I knew that I wanted to examine the way that film is able to enact social change. And right now, what I've been studying for sort of the past year and a half is film from the Arctic, which is very niche. I think when I tell people that, they're like, what even is Arctic cinema? Like, I didn't know that that existed, that films were made in the Arctic.
Right.
So as with everything else in academia, you sort of take a winding path and you end up niching down. And so I started as thinking about film in general, and then documentary film, and then now we're at Arctic cinema. So it started with one film that I saw in, I think it was 2019. It had come out in 2016 or 2017. It's called Angry Inuk by Alethea Arnakuk-Burrill, who is an Inuk filmmaker from Nunavut. And I was just so taken by this film. I think this was also when I first discovered Canadian film as a genre and Canadian documentary film, because people who don't study, you know, Canadian specific film, well, in Canada, we're sort of overtaken by the US, and most of the content that we watch is American content. But Canadian content is really up and coming, I think, and especially the Canadian documentary sector is really booming right now. But anyways, this documentary really impacted me because I had never seen, well, I just wasn't aware at all of the events that it was depicting or the subject matter.
Right.
So over the past couple of decades, there has been a lot of backlash against Inuit in the Arctic because of their animal consumption or the for their hunting practices.
Right.
Because historically, people in the Arctic have had to live off the land. You know, they didn't have access to grocery stores or modern conveniences or anything. And so they make do with the land and the animals around them. And so hunting, subsistence hunting is obviously a huge part of their lifestyles. And particularly seals, they make use of seals by using the entire animal. So it's called full utilization hunt. They will hunt the seal, they will eat the seal meat, and they will use the skin to keep them warm, like to make coats out of.
Right.
And so this is, they do it in, I guess you could call it an ethical way, because they're not raising these seals in like slaughterhouses the way that a lot of
and they only meat. using what they need.
Exactly. So compared to a lot of meat that is consumed in the South, here in the rest of Canada and the US, it is a much more ethical treatment of animals. But a lot of animal rights organizations did not see it that way. They took issue with it. They campaigned to various organizations and government, and they essentially got hunting in the Arctic banned. And obviously this had a huge impact on the people in the North, because this was their livelihood. This was the way that they ate food. This was the way that they made money. This was their entire economy, and it was just decimated because of a lack of understanding and also racism that people in the South had, because they were just not familiar with Inuit practices. And the film is about the way that people in the Arctic have been impacted and fighting back against the seal hunt ban.
Right. And that got you started.
Yes, that was the beginning.
That's a pretty major documentary that got you thinking in this area, because it sounds like a documentary that was really impactful.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it could upset some people, and I think this is where the pedagogy part comes in. It probably opened people's eyes on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is this a safe practice? Yes, and what's the cultural connection?
Yeah, absolutely. So from there, you know, when I was writing about this documentary, essentially at this point, my supervisor and my committee members come in, and, you know, they're always wreaking havoc on PhD students' projects.
Have you considered this?
You can't just focus on this film as a singular case study and sort of drop in and look at this film and then come out. You need to look at Arctic cinema as a whole. You need to understand the landscape here.
Right.
So you actually need to do a little bit more research to understand the Arctic and the history of filmmaking that has taken place there over the past 100 years. So that is what I did. And a year and a half later, I feel like I'm still working on it. I'm still researching. I've done a couple of presentations and I've had a few papers published. But yeah, it seems to never end.
But could you use that first film as a chapter to describe something, and then looking at more, of course?
Yeah. So that film, Angry Inuk, sort of became my main case study for one of my chapters. So it started everything, and it is still very much the central focus of one of my chapters.
What other ones have you looked at from up there? Because I understand there's other production companies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not an easy place to go and make a film, is there?
Yeah, absolutely. So Igloolik Isuma Productions was the first Inuit-owned production company in the Arctic. It was started in the late 80s by an Inuk filmmaker named Zacharias Kunuk. And without him and without this company, I don't think that the modern Arctic filmmaking that we see today would exist, because he was very much about creating Inuit film for Inuit and showing, sort of documenting the practices and cultural traditions of the people in the North, both as a way to show Southerners like us what the traditional practices were, and also to document them for people in the Arctic, many of whom might have been losing those practices or, you know, not speaking their traditional languages. And he started this tradition of Inuit filmmaking that has continued until today. And a lot of the films that this company, Asuma, made are very much about the environment and the land. So that has also been very important to my analysis, because the environment, as I mentioned, has been a very big part of my interest, particularly because so many documentaries that we see today in the 21st century are about climate change. And climate change is so prevalent in the Arctic. So that has been really interesting to watch as well.
So with some of this then, I mean, you can go and critique these films, these documentaries, like you did perhaps on the first one when you were explaining the first one. And you can keep critiquing, but what are you trying to accomplish by this critiquing or looking at these types of documentaries, in particular for the Arctic? What are you trying to accomplish here as part of your work, other than making an awareness that they're there?
Yeah. I think originally what I had hoped was to prove that documentaries are able to enact real world change. They're able to bring about legislation. They're able to bring about awareness that causes people to take action, to improve, you know, the social political climate, or to improve measures against climate change, these kind of things. And I still very much want to do that, but I think I've come to realize it's a lot more complicated than just saying this documentary led to this specific legislation.
Right.
So I think awareness is the main thing that I am focusing on now, because the documentaries that I've watched from the Arctic have taught me quite a bit. And so I want to help disseminate that knowledge, essentially. And I think this is particularly interesting for people who don't know much about Indigenous people in Canada, because in the South, I mean, we're both in Ontario, we, over the past few years, have learned quite a bit about, you know, residential schools and the 60s scoop, which mostly impacted Indigenous peoples in the South. But in the Arctic, it was a very different situation. And there's a lot of things that the Canadian government did to Inuit that I just was not aware of at all, that we're not taught in school.
And I think that's one of the things, and this is where the educational bit comes in, right? What people think about documentaries. I always think about, you know, David Attenborough with his BBC nature documentaries. But this is you showing, or these documentaries showing the life up north, which is harsh. It is really harsh, but they've been living that way for hundreds of years and sustained themselves really well. The problem is, like what's happening in the world with climate change, a lot of it's changing up there. So then either from the climate change or from political powers, so their lifestyle is being forcibly changed, either by people or by climate. And that's not easy, when it was a very precarious lifestyle anyway, because they do rely on just what's around them. Because like you said, it's too hard to fly in bucket loads of food to put into a grocery store. It's expensive. And they shouldn't have to change their culture.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of these films, like the Asuma films, are able to sort of document certain things that are able to continue these practices. For example, the language Inuktitut, there are articles talking about how Zacharias Canuck is helping revive the language in Okotok for future generations, because he's creating these films, employing people in the area, and ensuring that the teenagers are using and learning Inuktitut as part of the production. So film can not just the watching of film, but also the participation of film and like the way that it works as cultural reproduction. That is in and of itself a way to continue a culture.
Yeah, and I'm glad those production companies are doing that, because it is important for the youth today to not forget their history, their own history. Mm-hmm. It's too easy just to, oh, well, I'm just living in today. Well, a lot happened before you came into being, and it would be a shame to lose that. And I think what's nice about some of these documentaries is that if we take the time to watch them, it does remind us of things that have happened before, and either we should make sure that don't happen again, or you know, why did we lose that, and what can we do to bring it back?
Yeah,
and I think this is important for the Arctic. When you were looking at these films, did you have an opportunity to speak to anyone from the films themselves, or do you just you watched them yourself and went from there? I mean, because I wonder, with the work that you're doing on this, what are the people who made these films, or people up in the Arctic, what do they think about the fact that you're actually studying this mm-hmm. area?
So I don't know if you know anything about GREB, the...
Yes, the research ethics stuff.
Yeah, research ethics. So my committee members encouraged me not to go through that, because it just seems like such a huge process, which yes. is too bad, because I know that, you know, actually getting involved and speaking one-on-one and interviewing people could add an entire other aspect to my project.
Right.
But it seems like such a huge project in and of itself to just pass this review ethics board. So yeah.
Well, particularly, the scope of my particularly when it's coming with Indigenous people, right? Because there's the Indigenous ethics as well. Mm-hmm. And also having that in for them being comfortable.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have as much as possible, you know, been reading Indigenous texts, Indigenous feminist books, and doing my research through that lens, not through an extractive lens, but in order to like facilitate better learning and myself, because I am a settler. But yeah, just the scope of my project unfortunately has not allowed for actual interviews. That being said, luckily there are tons of interviews out there with all of the filmmakers. And in fact, just last night I went to a film screening. So there is actually a new TV show that has just been released in Canada, the first ever TV show shot in the Arctic. And of course, Alethea Arnacook-Burrill, who is a filmmaker behind Angry Inuk, she is the showrunner for this TV show.
Right.
So she has been the sort of force behind ensuring that filmmaking in the Arctic is viable right now. And so just last night, TIFF, Toronto International Film Festival, hosted a screening, and they had the cast and the crew on stage afterward to do a Q&A talking about the show, which was incredible, just hearing about how they are able to make TV shows in the North now, and it's supported by Netflix. So, you know, it's really becoming more viable, rather than seeing Inuit having to come south, you know, to Toronto or Vancouver or wherever and make films there. It's actually possible to make films in the North. So I'm hoping that we will be able to see more of that.
It's interesting that Netflix has picked it up, which is great, because mm-hmm. a lot of people, this is going to sound awful, as soon as most people think documentaries are done by National Geographic, mm-hmm. and they do a lot, and they mm-hmm, do a great mm-hmm. job, but just the word National Geographic can put some people off, because they think it was just education.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas yes. if it's Netflix, they may look at it rightly or wrongly in a different way if it's accessible through Netflix.
Exactly. Access is a whole other thing. If it shows up on someone's Netflix page, you know, they're not even doing any extra work to like research this show or try to find it anywhere. It's just there when they go to watch something. So it is called North of North. I should mention
North of North. Title.
And it's on CBC Gem right now, free streaming, but it will also be on Netflix in the spring, is what they said.
That's great. That's really good. And there was something else I was going to say about the access part. Because, I mean, I've learned lots from documentaries, and the reason I brought up Why the Arctic is because there's ones that, you know, documentaries, what's happening in war-torn areas, and documentaries mm-hmm. on the animals and, you know, all those sorts of things. And I mean, I remember I saw a good one about, it was called The Octopus is My Teacher or
my
something.
My Octopus Teacher.
My Octopus. Oh, my God. That was unbelievable. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Cried, but loved it. I never thought I would be that excited to meet a little octopus.
Oh, and I think that one was on either Netflix or...
It won an award, didn't it?
Or Disney Plus. Yeah, I think that won the Oscar for Best Doc that year. And that's actually a great way for people to find out about documentaries. Because, you know, a lot of people don't watch any documentaries, but they do try to watch all the big Oscar films. And so they will end up watching those five documentaries. So at least they're getting some documentary consumption is in. And, you know, usually they are quite heavy. But there is one or two that are a bit lighter or about cute animals like My Octopus Teacher. Yeah. So hopefully with the Oscars coming up soon, more people will be watching the films that were nominated this year.
Which is great because because they have won some already, some of the films that you've mentioned, they've won different awards and things. Do you think... I mean, you mentioned before you don't think doing this work is going to necessarily change legislature or anything like that. But do you still have the same hope in the capacity of documentary film to enact social change as you did when you first started? Because I think this is important, because even just this, I've got a bit more excited about documentaries. And sometimes it's just a matter of being exposed to it more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely have hope. I do think that documentary can at least move the needle in terms of the climate conversation or like specific socio-political issues that we're having now. People are become more aware. But I was at a documentary film festival, I think it was a year or 2 years ago, and there was a session where they talked about change through nonfiction cinema. Right. And one of the filmmakers on that panel, even though he makes documentary film, he said something like, you know, I'm a bit more cynical now than I was a few years ago, because there's hundreds and hundreds of films about the environment out, but climate change is still happening, you know, like what?
So we haven't learned.
Not what's the point, but like it's, you know, we haven't changed the world. But I think we have in some ways, you know, there's still people like myself who do try to make a difference, who try to participate in becoming more conscious consumers and teaching other people about that and consuming environmental content. There, I think awareness is not necessarily enough, but it is one step. And as I said, it does move the needle. It might not be enough to change things by itself, but in tandem with activism and legislation, I think that it can change things.
Do you think then documentaries, because documentaries don't have to be long, some of them can be quite short. Do you think this is an area, and I'm going to go back to education again, where the education system should be bringing more documentary film into their curriculum? Because you could watch a short film, a short documentary, you can critique it, you know, what like we're doing with these sorts of conversations. What do you think the main point they're trying to get across here? And, you know, and that's such a great learning experience. And that might actually get the kids then thinking a little differently. Because, I mean, the change for anything is going to happen from the kids coming through. not necessarily from us adults, who a lot of people are stuck in their own ways and go, well, it's not going to impact me any. I'm going to be dead before it has a problem. Bit drastic. But you think it should be, you know, even documentary makers should be looking at, you know, you could do a feature film. I don't know how long documentaries are meant to be, but then do a short form that could go into a classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, that was one of my original hopes when I started my PhD. I wanted to help documentaries become seen as tools of pedagogy that that people could use in schools. And there's actually some film festivals who are trying to do this. Hot Docs, which is based in Toronto, has a program called Docs for Schools, where teachers can bring in their classes to this Docs for Schools program so that the students can watch a documentary. And then there is curriculum that is based around that.
Right.
So there are definitely organizations that do that. But yeah, I fully agree. I think, like, when I was in school, we would occasionally watch films, but the only documentary that I remember watching was An Inconvenient Truth, which was sort of my awakening to, like, environmental change.
Right.
I was that age. And I think that, yeah, showing documentaries in school is hugely helpful, because there is something that film can do, like conveying information in a way that just reading a document or reading a textbook, it's just not as effective as seeing on screen, you know, seeing actual
most,
people.
Yeah, because most people are more visual. They like the visual. I love the visuals. If I want to understand every single word, I'm better off reading, but I love visuals because, again, I don't have to think too hard. You're showing me. So, you know, I don't have to think too hard about what the page means.
Exactly.
It's there in front.
With the example of Angry Inuk, you know, you could see it was a story. It was showing how these people were actually impacted by the legislation rather than just reading a chapter about the seal ban. You know, that is not going to go as far as seeing people whose livelihoods were decimated because of this legislation.
Yeah. And you're seeing where they're living. You're seeing the actual environment, not trying to imagine it from a page, what's written on a page.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. So what's next then for you? Are you going to become, after this, become a film critic or?
Well, first is to finish. I still have one more chapter to write. I still am planning to do a chapter on the actual distribution part of filmmaking. So that is going to focus more on, like, film festivals and how film is disseminated, which sort of ties into that pedagogy aspect, you know, showing documentaries for schools. I want to show how activist groups and community organizations can harness the power of film and how that is able to impact people, which is sort of the, you know, my overall thesis. But after that, I'm not sure. I still am very interested in film festivals and film organizations. So I would love to work in sort of community outreach or working in film festivals, something along those lines, where I am able to tie pedagogy and also community and also just my overall love of film.
That's great. I think people would be very jealous if you're able to do that.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a position for hire at the moment. I don't know where.
I'm sure you'll find it. Because there are, as you said, there are some great film festivals on both in Canada and around the world. And, you know, if we can, particularly with documentaries, if we can get more people watching them, we might have a chance. And to show, documentaries can be fun. It's not all doom and gloom. A documentary doesn't have to be doom and gloom the whole time. You know, there's other sides to them as well. So, because I think that's another misconception, that they're all doom and gloom and they're too dark.
Yes. Yeah. If you want to watch a light film on a Friday night, as I say, you're not going to go for a documentary. One, because you don't want to be taught, but two, because you want something light. But again, there are light and uplifting documentaries. It's just they're maybe a bit harder to find.
And maybe we need to bring, you know, a combination of documentaries to show within documentary filmmaking the differences.
Yeah.
To still get our message across. Well, Lara, you've only got one chapter to go, so that's good. Most people say, oh, well, I've just got a first draft. So that's really good. I wish you all the best with that. And I really do appreciate you coming online to do this interview with me. So thank you for that. And telling us a bit more about the filmmaking up in the Arctic, which is fascinating.
Of course. Well, I hope that this inspires people to watch more documentaries. You know, it's watching the Oscar nominees for the year is a great place to start, but also the National Film Board online. Like, they have so many free films on there, including Angry Inuk. So, yeah, check out National Film Board and, you know, film festivals around you.
That's great. Well, thank you very much. And enjoy the rest of your day, I guess.
Thank you. You as well.
And the next film festival you're going to be working on. So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray!
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.